Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter. And later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us America's Presidents. But first, slowly, North Korea is entering the online world. Thanks to technology, North Korean doctors can talk to patients through online video conferencing. Speeches given at Kim Il-sung University in Pyongyang, the capital, can be seen at faraway factories. North Koreans send text messages to each other on their smartphones. People are even buying products and doing their banking online. Yet, North Korea is still among the least internet-friendly countries on Earth. For most citizens, having a connection to the World Wide Web is unimaginable. Hardly anyone has a personal computer or an email address that is not shared. But for Kim Jong-un, the country's first leader to grow up in the internet age, the idea of a more wired North Korea is also appealing. It comes with the promise of new forms of social and political control, and the possibility of cyber attacks on the West. The North Korean government's solution is a two-level system where the upper class can use the internet more freely, while others use a national intranet. The intranet system is cut off from the outside world and closely watched by the government.
Park Soon-jin is a 30-year-old postgraduate student in chemistry. He goes to the SciTech complex on Suk Island to do his schoolwork. The large building, a science and technology center, houses North Korea's largest e-library. It has more than 3,000 computers where people can do research or study subjects. Park has some experience with the internet, but on a supervised, need-only basis. If he needs anything from the World Wide Web, university officials will find it for him. One recent day, Park used North Korea's national intranet called Kwangmyong. An official at the SciTech complex said the intranet has 168 sites. Park also uses a browser called Naenara, which means my country in Korean. It is like a version of Firefox, except only North Koreans can use it. North Korea's national intranet is unusual, even compared to other countries with internet restrictions. Countries like China and Iran, for example, control what their citizens see online, but through censorship and blocking, not complete separation.
Most North Korean computers use the Red Star operating system, developed from Linux open source coding. Red Star 3.0 has the usual software, like the Naenara browser, email, and even KPhoto. Many of the programs look like Apple products. Any attempt to change its operations or remove virus checkers results in the computer restarting. Files downloaded from USBs are marked so that officials can identify criminal activity. This prevents the spread of information from other countries. Red Star also takes screenshots of what is being shown on computer screens. The images cannot be removed and are only available to trained government officials. Nat Gretchen is with the U.S. government-financed Open Technology Fund. He says the software in Red Star and the mobile operating systems of phones and tablets show a new way for the North Korean government to control information. In the past, information in North Korea was mainly controlled through government agents, such as the State Security Ministry's Thought Police. But in the Internet age, North Korean officials have learned to use online devices as another tool for gathering information.
The most common online experience for North Koreans is on a smartphone. 10 years ago, only a small number of military officials had such devices. Now, the main phone provider says there are 2.5 to 3 million mobile phones in North Korea, a country of 25 million people. The spread of mobile phones is one of the biggest success stories during the rule of Kim Jong-un. It began in 2008 under former leader Kim Jong-il and has risen quickly over the past 5 years. It is easy for North Koreans to buy telephones, but the phones must be registered and approved. With local phones, North Koreans are able to call, text, play games, go on the national intranet, and use other services. But they cannot receive or make calls to numbers outside that network. Wi-Fi use is also banned for North Koreans. Foreigners in North Korea must use a different system and cannot make calls to or receive calls from local numbers. They can buy local phones if they want, but the apps and normal software will be removed. It will also be coded so that the apps cannot be added later.
While blocking most North Koreans from the internet, the government gives access to a small group of people, including North Korean leaders and the upper class. There is strong evidence that the government gives people involved in cyber attacks the access they need. U.S. officials say the North launched the WannaCry attack, which infected hundreds of thousands of computers in May and damaged parts of Britain's National Health Service. North Korean hackers have been linked to attacks on the Bangladeshi Central Bank last year and on South Korean banks going back to 2013. There was also the 2014 hack of Sony Pictures over the release of The Interview, a film dealing with a plot to kill Kim Jong-un. The North Korean government has denied hacking accusations. Bo Woods of the Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council warned that a more cyber-active North Korea could be very dangerous.
International scientists think the amount of carbon dioxide emissions released into Earth's atmosphere will rise by 2% in 2017. The number represents the first increase in worldwide carbon emissions in 3 years. The amount produced was unchanged from 2014 to 2016. Carbon dioxide, known by the chemical expression CO2, is a colorless gas found in nature. Many scientists believe that it and other gases released by factories, vehicles, and other human activities are responsible for a general warming on our planet. They believe these gases trap the sun's heat in the atmosphere. This effect is known as global warming. Last week, scientists with the Global Carbon Project reported that China, the world's largest producer of CO2, is the main reason for the increase in emissions. China's emissions are predicted to rise by over 3% this year. As a result, the scientists warn that emission goals set by the Paris Agreement on climate change will be more difficult to reach. Corinne Le Carré is the lead researcher for the Global Carbon Project. In a statement, she said, "With global CO2 emissions from all human activities estimated at 41 billion tons for 2017, time is running out on our ability to keep warming well below 2 degrees Celsius, let alone 1.5 degrees Celsius." The group's report came as representatives from more than 190 countries met in Germany to discuss details of the climate agreement. The Paris Agreement on Climate Change is an international deal meant to keep the Earth's atmosphere from warming too much. Governments agreed in 2015 on a long-term goal of keeping the global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The United Nations website for Paris Agreement issues notes that 170 parties have approved the deal. The United States signed the Paris Agreement in 2016. But President Donald Trump has announced plans to withdraw the U.S. from the deal. He said it does not treat all parties equally and could hurt America's economic growth. In 2017, U.S. carbon emissions are predicted to decrease by 0.4% from the year before. American emissions have been falling for several years, although the decrease is expected to slow in 2017. The Global Carbon Project report blames the increased use of coal for China's increased emissions and slowing declines in the United States. The scientists released their findings in the Global Carbon Budget as the UN was holding a conference on climate change in Bonn, Germany. The international gathering was the first of its kind since the U.S. said it plans to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. However, U.S. State Department officials attended the Bonn conference. So did some U.S. lawmakers and the governor of California, Jerry Brown. The conference is part of a 1994 U.N. convention that sets goals for reducing carbon emissions. The idea of the U.N. effort is to limit temperature increases in the Earth's atmosphere and the risks tied to climate change. Many of the delegates in Bonn were negotiating details of the Paris Agreement. These include emissions targets for countries that have signed and approved the deal. The agreement, however, is non-binding, meaning it does not have the force of law. I'm Mario Ritter.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Gerald Ford. Ford was the 38th president, but he was never elected to the position. Instead, an unusual series of events brought him there. Many historians have described Ford as a good man facing a difficult situation. He tried to fix a troubled economy, end United States involvement in Vietnam, and show people that the U.S. government could continue to operate after a crisis. Critics from the two main political parties had problems with Ford's efforts, and voters did not elect him president when they had the chance in 1976. But he is remembered in American history for making many voters feel better about their elected officials. When he was born, the future president was given his father's name, Leslie Lynch King. But the boy's father was abusive. His mother separated from him a short time after their son was born. She asked a court for permission to cancel their marriage. Her request was quickly approved. She and the boy moved from the Midwestern state of Nebraska to Michigan. In a few years, the mother married a man named Gerald Ford. The couple had three sons together. The new family was warm and loving. In time, the oldest boy officially took his stepfather's name and became Gerald Rudolph Ford, Jr. He was called Jerry for short. Growing up, Jerry Ford was a well-liked person and a good student. He was also a top football player. He was named the most valuable player on his team at the University of Michigan. After finishing college, he was offered work with professional football teams. But Ford wanted to continue his education instead. He accepted coaching positions for the football and boxing teams at Yale University in Connecticut. In time, he attended the law school there. Ford's path to politics was similar to that of other presidents during that period. He worked at a law office in his home state. He fought in World War II. He married. Ford's wife was Elizabeth Bloomer. Her friends called her Betty. She had been a dancer and worked as a fashion model. The Fords went on to have four children. When Gerald Ford was 35 years old, he launched his political career. The Republican Party chose him as its candidate for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Ford was elected to represent his home area of Grand Rapids, Michigan. But unlike many other politicians, he did not move on to the Senate or become governor of a state. Instead, he stayed in the House of Representatives for 25 years. The job of congressman was, in many ways, a good choice for Ford. He was well-liked by many voters and other lawmakers. He could help different groups come to agreement. He took increasingly important positions on political issues, and in time became the top person in his party in the House. Ford was a strong supporter of Republican presidents. In the 1968 election, Ford advocated for Richard Nixon. Ford liked Nixon's plans for the United States, as well as his efforts to improve relations with China and the Soviet Union. Both Ford and Nixon were re-elected to their positions in 1972. But by then, major problems had come to light in Nixon's administration. One problem in the early 1970s related to Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew. Agnew had been vice president since 1969. 5 years later, officials found evidence that he had accepted money from contractors, both while Maryland's governor and as vice president. In answer, Agnew resigned from the presidency. Normally, voters elect a vice president, along with a president, every 4 years. But by coincidence, the U.S. Constitution had recently been updated to say what happens if the country needs a vice president unexpectedly. It states that the president has to nominate someone for the position. Then, a majority of lawmakers in Congress must agree. So, in 1973, Nixon nominated Gerald Ford to take Agnew's position. Nixon was not especially close to Ford, but he knew a majority of lawmakers would likely accept him as vice president. They did. However, Ford did not serve in the position long. In 8 months, another unexpected event put him in the Oval Office. In August 1974, President Richard Nixon resigned from office. He was the first president to do so. As a result, the vice president, Gerald Ford, became president. Ford was sworn in as president on August 9, 1974. Then he spoke to the nation on television. He said, "My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over." He told people, "Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not men." The public had understandably lost a good deal of faith in government officials, and especially in Richard Nixon. Ford wanted to reestablish their trust. But a few weeks after taking office, Ford used his presidential powers to pardon Nixon. The pardon meant that Nixon would never face a criminal trial, or, if found guilty, punishment for his actions. Ford said he believed pardoning Nixon would help Americans begin to recover from their painful experience with the former president. But instead, the move angered many people. They believed that Nixon should be held responsible. They also lost some of their trust in Ford. In addition to these political troubles, Ford faced other difficult issues. The American economy was struggling. His administration had to deal with unemployment, inflation, and the lasting effects of an energy crisis. The high price of oil imports came at a time when Americans were using more and more gasoline. Ford took steps aimed at improving the economy, but critics said he was not consistent. Some criticized him for increasing government spending and cutting taxes. Others criticized him for reducing government spending and raising taxes. Ford also oversaw the withdrawal of Americans from Vietnam An earlier agreement had brought a ceasefire to groups in South Vietnam, North Vietnam, and communist forces. The U.S. officially withdrew its combat troops in 1973, but the fighting restarted. Ford asked Congress to approve military and humanitarian aid for the area, but U.S. lawmakers did not approve the full amount, and in time, they cut military aid. In 1975, communist forces began to take control of Saigon, the capital of South Vietnam. Ford ordered all remaining Americans in the country to leave, along with any South Vietnamese who were connected to the United States. He said that, as far as Americans were concerned, the Vietnam War was finished. Americans did not appear to blame Ford for the troubling end of the country's involvement in Vietnam. And some recognized that the country's economic and energy problems had started long before he became president. But in general, Ford did not have the support of Congress, and many voters did not forgive him for pardoning Nixon. In 1976, Ford officially campaigned for president for the first time. He won his party's nomination in a close race against Ronald Reagan, the former governor of California. But he lost the general election to the Democratic candidate, who said one of his best qualities was that he did not have experience in the federal government. The argument appeared persuasive to many voters, who still did not appear to be enthusiastic about the government. In the 1976 election, nearly half of all people who were legally able to vote chose not to. Ford left the presidency graciously. He said that, because he had not planned to be president, he was thankful for the unexpected opportunity. Although Ford said he was ready to retire from politics, he continued to be active in public life. He advised others on government affairs, published books, and sat on boards and committees. His wife, Betty Ford, also left a lasting effect on the public. As First Lady, she had spoken about her experience with breast cancer. After her husband left the presidency, she also spoke openly about her battle with alcohol and drug abuse. In 1982, Betty Ford co-founded the Betty Ford Center in California to help people get treatment for drug addiction. She announced her husband's death in 2006. Gerald Ford died of heart disease at the age of 93. By that time, most of the public had accepted that one of Ford's biggest achievements was to help the country recover after Nixon resigned. President Bill Clinton gave Ford a Presidential Medal of Freedom for his efforts. And even Jimmy Carter, who beat Ford in the 1976 presidential election, began his inauguration speech by thanking Ford. Carter said, "For myself and for our nation, I want to thank my predecessor for all he has done to heal our land." I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.